Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Mets fans, welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. Somehow this is the first time that Chris and I have done a podcast together in over a month, so I am Brian Salvatore. With me, as always, is Chris McShane. It's been a while, my friend.
Yeah, one of those things that the weeks kind of added up, and there was no significant Mets news, and then all of a sudden there was.
All of a sudden there was a flurry of Mets news. And so because you haven't had a chance to comment on it, real quickly, Carlos Beltran as Mets manager, you have 30 seconds, go.
Oh, I'm thrilled. We were looking back at the episodes we had done just before we recorded this, and one of the last things we talked about was pulling for Beltran. I think that was the episode's title. So, I've used most of my 30 seconds, but hell yes, Beltran is back. I don't care about Beltran in the sense of whatever the Astros were doing. And I mean, it was pretty clear what the Astros were doing.
Yeah.
I don't care about any of that. I think his assets will be useful to this team. And I hope they give him the best roster they can so that he has a really good chance to succeed. So... Yeah. Thrilled, shocked still that like that's happening. There's other shocking things that we'll get to in a minute, but Carlos Beltran is back. I don't know. Maybe everybody knew something. Maybe that bridge wasn't really mended, but they were like, "Eh, I just give it to him. Who cares?" But yeah, he was one of my favorite players to watch in a Mets uniform. And I think the intelligence with which he played the game will be helpful to them in the role he's in now. So very happy about that.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I've already spoken about this on the show, so I will shut my mouth and move on to the... I mean, this isn't just the biggest topic of the week. This isn't just the biggest topic of the year. This is potentially the Mets story of the decade, and they're getting it in at the very last minute. I know that sounds hyperbolic, but you and I were talking earlier today on Slack, and we both said we never thought we would see the day that this is happening. And if all goes to plan, it looks like the Wilpons are about to sell a majority of their stake in the Mets, 80% to be specific. Is that 80% of their stake in the Mets or 80% of the team?
I guess I haven't seen that specific thing spelled out, and maybe I missed it somewhere. But knowing the background, there have been multiple stories about Saul Katz wanting out basically because his kids didn't want to deal with
Jeffy
sorting things out with Jeff Wilpon. Once Saul Katz and Fred Wilpon passed on, Jeff Wilpon was so impossible to work with, or is, that the families would rather get rid of the team than leave it to the kids to have to fight out with him.
Get rid of a literal money-making machine.
Something that was worth a good amount of money when they took it over as the sole ownership group.
In 2002, I believe that happened, correct? They bought out Nelson Doubleday in 2002?
Yeah, I think that's when that was finalized. So you take that, and I forget exactly what the amount was, but we know that what they're working at, the valuation they're working on with Steve Cohen is $2.6 billion, which would be the most valuable sports franchise ever sold. Up to this point, as I understand it. So that's just a slight return on the investment.
Yes.
So yeah, yeah. It whether or not it's specifically 80% of the team or 80% of their stake, because we know there was a point that they had sold. Cohen got in, according to everything that's been reported. He got in around the time that the Mets needed some other investors. And what's weird is that back at that time, I thought I recall hearing that those investors weren't necessarily getting a percentage of the team, but they were getting a bunch of perks, and they were, you know, joining part of Mets ownership.
Whatever. Famously, Bill Maher is part of that group.
Yes.
Yeah. Always pleasant, Bill Maher. yeah, I want to say that they were not getting. Oh, geez, I forget the language now. But you're right. There was something that they weren't getting. It wasn't as simple as they're paying X amount of money for X percent ownership.
Right.
But yeah, I don't remember the specifics of it. But let's just unpack this for a second. So, you know, I'm going to look this up quickly. I'm trying to find out when Fred Wilpon first bought into the Mets.
I think it was the early 80s.
I think so, too. So let's see. In 1980, Wilpon bought a 1% stake in the Mets. In 86, Nelson Doubleday Jr. sold the company. Blah, blah, blah. Wilpon had right of first refusal in the event of a sale and threatened to exercise it. In the resulting settlement, Wilpon and Doubleday agreed to purchase the Mets for $81 million, becoming equal partners in the team. So in 86, he became a 50% owner of the team.
Yeah.
So I was 4 years old when he became one of the two primary owners. I was 20 years old when he became the sole owner of the team. And I really thought that this would be a situation where Jeff Wilpon would own the team until it was pried from him in whatever sense. It seemed to me like the Wilpons were not going to easily give up their stake. And I understand why the Katz family maybe feels the way that they do about working with Jeff, but I'm surprised that Jeff and Fred did not just try and buy him out proper.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They have so much money. I think because Mets fans are so used to the narrative that the Wilpons are cheap, they don't realize the actual net worth of the Wilpons, which is insane.
Yeah, and yet it is dwarfed by
yes,
by the guy that they're working on selling the team to.
Well, how much is Cohen supposedly worth?
Somewhere around $10 billion, maybe more.
Let's see. Let's see what Wilpon's worth. It says that Wilpon has a net worth of $500 million. So, yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that goes up if you get the money for the team.
I guess so. Yeah, but you would think that Katz would be able to be bought out by the Wilpons if they really wanted to.
In theory. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe that, and to be clear, this is all speculation.
Oh, all but, of this is rampant speculation, yes.
But maybe it speaks to, I don't know, a lack of being able to actually use money right now.
Sure.
For that sort of thing. Or I don't know, maybe deep down, Fred Wilpon knows that the Mets should not be left as an entity to Jeff.
Man, we're getting into some Hamlet shit here.
Yeah, no, it's I still can't believe if Carlos Beltran coming back to the Mets organization in any way is shocking. I don't know the word for this.
Yeah.
Truly never thought, I mean, to borrow from The Good Place, holy forking shirt balls. Like, like what? There's, and also to be clear, this is not finalized, but it's official enough that the team put out a statement about where they're at in the negotiations and this concept of Fred and Jeff remaining in, you know, roles that they currently have within the Mets for the next 5 years. I think everybody who has seen the percentage of the team that they're potentially selling has looked at it and said, like, yeah, okay. Like, if this gets finalized, they're not here in 3 years. Or if they are, they're just, they're becoming what their minority investors became earlier this decade.
Right, yeah.
They hang out in the ownership suite. They're part of the ownership group. But they're not, you know, they're not walking around the office in charge of things, pretending that they can participate in baseball operations and all that. Yeah. don't know. A friend, as the news was breaking, one friend reached out and was like, does this mean there's a light at the end of the tunnel? And I really feel like that's the appropriate cliche to use right now.
Sure. Yeah.
It feels like, yes, there is.
So I have a bunch of questions that we're not going to be able to answer, but I feel like are interesting to talk about. Do you think that this will limit their spending over this offseason because they know that their investment is essentially coming up in a couple of years, and so they're not going to go into any further hawk than they already are?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Obviously, what we're all dreaming of is new guy with more money than anybody could ever figure out what to do with, says, I'm putting money in. Let's make this team the most successful team it can be starting right now.
Right.
You know, we saw John Heyman tweet earlier today that's not the case. It's not, you know, it's not quite Christmas yet for Mets fans, I think was how he put it. That, I mean, all the reporting around this sounds like it's definitely going to happen. But his point was that influx of money isn't going to be part of the equation for Cole, Strasburg, Rendon. You know, it would be nice if it could happen that quickly. I think we're all...
I can't imagine it happening that quickly, but yes, it would be very nice.
Yeah, no, I think what you dream on is the next couple classes of elite free agents might be in play, especially sure. If this process accelerates. But I think, and hey, I'd love to be surprised, but I think we get one more like 100% Wilponian, I will say, off season.
Yes,
and I then agree. As things move on and you know, maybe this all becomes official and
so that was my first question for you. My second question for you is sort of a longer view at the look at this. You know, we saw in our lifetime George Steinbrenner go from villain to hero to saint after he died. What do you think that the opinion of the Wilpons as you know, poor owners ever really goes away?
I can't see that.
I mean, to be fair, for the first 20 years of their ownership, I think people might have had some gripes, but overall, I mean, the Mets spent money all through the 90s and early 2000s. They spent money poorly a lot of times. You know, I think we can all name 15 players off the top of our heads that the Mets signed that were foolish. You know, it was only after the Madoff thing that they became inept in the sense of them not spending money to put the best team on the field. But I can't... you know, we've seen some folks saying over the last couple of days that the Wilpons wanted to win. And I truly believe that. I think that the Wilpons did have more of a vested interest in the Mets' success than a lot of ownership groups do. But in part of that is because it's not an ownership group. It's Jeff and Fred. And so right. It's easier to say, like, oh, those two guys really want to win than, like, this nameless, I mean, this faceless corporation that controls the percentage, blah, blah, blah. But I do think that they care, but I don't see how history is really going to redeem them. Do you disagree?
I don't. I think the Steinbrenner story is so unique and every possible way, to go from being banned or long-term suspended from participating in Major League Baseball to having a statue in the lobby and having his face just sort of hovering over the bleachers. I think that's still a thing. It's like printed on a wall. I guess this is just a random tangent about the Yankees, but the weirdness of all that and the weirdness of how they handled Monument Park and the new stadium and everything, I don't know. I don't get it. It doesn't really fit. Like, if you were going with the Yankees brand, I don't know. You would think that there would be like the statue would be in Monument Park and it would be surrounded by all these retired numbers and it wouldn't be just like some, like the type of print you would put on the side of a bus.
Right.
Hanging over the bleachers and a statue that's in part of the lobby of the stadium that most people never see. I don't know. Anyway. I just don't see any way that you can get that kind of redemption because there's nothing. Strangely enough, the low points for the Wilpons weren't anywhere near as low as they were for Steinbrenner, and the highs haven't been anywhere near as high. So, you know, Steinbrenner had those lows earlier, relatively speaking, and then the high points all came mainly with the Dynasty Yankees. Of the late 90s and 2000. And then, was he still around for 2009? He was, right?
Maybe. Keep talking. I'll look it up.
Yeah, I think he was.
Yes, he died in 2010.
Right, okay. So he gets that run of several World Series championships and then one more. And I just don't see, like, the thing that people might want to build a statue of the Wilpons for would be, like, they sold the team.
Yeah. I mean, and look, a lot of the Mets' ills have nothing to do with the Wilpons. I feel like we really do have to say that because people like me, admittedly, will occasionally turn the Wilpons into the boogeymen for everything, you know. But ultimately, the Wilpons were never able to truly cultivate a sustainable winning team. You know, it's amazing when you look at how dominant the Mets were from 84 to 88, let's call it. You know, there was only a couple of playoff appearances in there, but those teams, I mean, back in the day, maybe our younger listeners aren't aware of just how hard it was to get into the playoffs in the 80s, you know, with two divisions and it was just impossible. But anyway, 84 to 88, the team was excellent. Two playoff appearances to show for it. They don't make the playoffs again for another 11 years. They make the playoffs 2 years in a row. They don't make the playoffs after that for another 6 years. They don't make the playoffs after that for another 9 years. And they get two appearances in a row there. You know, for a team in New York with the amount of natural talent that a lot of those teams had and homegrown cheap talent that a lot of those teams had, you have to sort of point the finger at the Wilpons for not hiring the right people. And that I'm not saying they should be baseball ops people, even though they act like baseball ops people, but they should have been able to hire people to to shepherd those teams into greater success.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It would have been nice, but I think, you know, there's always that question of how much of the credit or blame goes to the person who was in charge of baseball operations and how much meddling was involved. And I don't know. Maybe the best thing about all of this is that we get some honest accounting of what the hell happened with this team and the way it was run. We've gotten some good reporting, and I think we have a good idea that things were not normal and it wasn't a well-oiled machine.
Yes.
But it would be nice to get sort of a tell-all from somebody once this is final.
My greatest wish is that on the first day of the first season without the Wilpons, David Wright comes out of retirement for one at-bat, and we can bribe whoever's pitching to groove him a curveball, and he can hit a home run to prove to Fred Wilpon that he was a superstar. And that he survived Fred Wilpon. That he lasted longer than Fred Wilpon.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say that one good thing about a Mets fan who has all this money buying the team is that that's somebody who might understand what David Wright means to the organization. You know, I know that he's been close with the Wilpons despite that incident.
Yes.
And isn't it nice when like a prearranged interview for a story turns into something that years and decades later we can refer to as an incident?
Yeah.
Hey, this reporter wants to talk to you about these topics. You know, there was no reaction to that story that was like, whoa, 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 that was off the record, or, you know, we were ambushed. They didn't react like that. They were just like, yep, sorry. He said those things. Yeah. Anyway, we could podcast for hours and hours on end on yes. Random things that the Wilpons did over the last, over our entire lives that we've had memories, basically.
Yes, essentially. So yeah, is there any other sort of Wilpon related stuff you want to get to?
What's the line from Hitchhiker's Galaxy? So long and thanks for all the fish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that might be it. I guess the one relevant thing, and I know part of this is what Nate is writing up about the Wilpons, the headline he's using. But one thing is that one of Eric Simon's favorite Simpsons lines is smell you later, or, oh God, how did I, smell you later forever.
Yes.
Is what I was trying to get to. Sorry for butchering that. But anyway,
okay.
Nate sort of calling back to one of Eric's favorite things, it ties it all up nicely, I think, in terms of the Amazing Avenue perspective on on this ownership group.
Yeah. It'll be very interesting to see sort of what a new owner will keep from under the hood. You know, will they be bringing in their own general manager? Will they bring in their own, you know, departments? And that's what it's going to be very interesting to see how this all shakes out. And because it is going to be a 4 to 5 year process, it's going to be, you're going to see incremental changes, but there probably isn't going to be anything all that big right away. So as exciting as this is, you know, we have to temper our excitement a little bit. Is that your dog or is that a dog toy?
Well, it is a toy.
Okay. I was hoping it was. Okay.
Yes. We have a puppy named Yoda. He's on Instagram. He's at Yoda the Bronx Yorkie, all spelled out. We had that name a few days before, or the idea to name him that was in our minds Then we saw the first episode of The Mandalorian, and then we were like, well, yeah, I guess we're getting this dog. And then three nights later, I think it was a Monday that the first episode of The Mandalorian came out.
A Tuesday, yeah.
Oh, Tuesday? Okay, then two nights later. So, you know, we know early in that week that we're going to meet this guy, and he's awesome. But we know we're going to meet him. And then Tuesday night, we watched that episode, and we're like, okay, yep. That's clearly, like, this is, he'd have to be the worst dog in the world for us to go meet him and be like, nah, I don't think so. So yeah, that is Yoda. He is entertaining himself right now, which is great. And yeah. Over the next few episodes, you will probably hear a variety of noises related to him.
All right, well, welcome to the family, Yoda.
Yes, he's thanking you.
This episode is sponsored by Stash, a smarter, simpler way to start investing. With Stash, you can begin investing in a wide array of companies and diversified funds for as little as $5. Stash offers unlimited trading with no add-on trading commissions, so you can invest without worrying about getting nickel and dimed. You can choose your own stocks and funds to build a personalized portfolio or let Stash help build one for you. Stash demystifies investing with personalized financial guidance and education. They can even help you set up a plan for retirement saving. Stash will give you $10 today to get started investing. Just visit www.stash.app with the code SBNation. That's www.stash.app with code SBNation to get your $10 to start investing on Stash. Investment advisory services offered by Stash Investments LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. For disclosures and to learn how to claim your $10 to invest, visit www.stash.app.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
All right, so we got a fun email that I want to read to you. This is from our friend Sean. Since Carlos Beltran as the new Mets manager is reigniting talk of the old unironic hashtag blame Beltran fans, I was thinking of other players who've been disliked by a small but vocal part of the fan base for a combination of misperceived lack of hustle and or missing out on a big moment. I'd nominate Conforto as the current hashtag blame Beltran Met, as a weird mix of wild expectations and a polar bear have some fans convinced he's disappointing. And then Sean added, he's not. Who would be some of your hashtag blame Beltran all-timers? Lucas Duda definitely fits the bill. I would have said Familia before this past season, and I was a big fan of the move at the time. Maybe even Kenny Rogers, who was only in that game because Franco and Benitez couldn't get it done. Anyway, I'll wrap up by asking Brian and Chris what your favorite Hold Steady album is. I'm a Separation Sunday all the way guy, but it's a tough call. Real quick, do you have a favorite Hold Steady record?
I don't. I never really got into them, so sorry about that.
Boys and Girls in America is my answer.
Okay, nice. I know they are in the midst, as we're recording this, I think they're on night 204 at Brooklyn Bowl of like a...
Yes, I believe so.
Crazy, you know, run of shows and all that. They're a band that was often around, talked about, written about, alongside a lot of things that I love and just never clicked for me. So maybe at some point I'll have an answer. I'm glad you had one though.
Yes, I did. So who makes the all blame Beltran team?
I think David Wright does.
Yeah. I think that the Wright hatred is from the smallest percentage of these type of players. Like if you looked at the player people who booed Duda, let's say it was 40% of Mets fans, right? I think only 5% of Mets fans booed Wright, but they were violent in their hatred of David Wright.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I'm trying to think, I mean, before giving actual answers, my generic answer to this would be who was the best player on the Mets at any given time.
Yeah.
And that was probably the guy. I know Piazza got over it.
Yeah.
But you know, there was some of that
early there was a building. Lot of that though.
There was. But that, you know, that didn't last forever. Yeah, I don't know. I'm having a tough time coming up with specific examples, but I've felt over the years it's extremely common for the best players on the team to get hated on the most.
Yes.
So Granderson might have. I know I'm going with like recent stuff here. I just it's hard to remember when we were a little younger. Like, oh, the late 90s Mets, they were great. Nobody hated anybody. Like that, or at least it felt that way. You know?
I would argue that maybe Bobby Valentine was that guy for that team.
Yeah. Well, I guess he's managing the team that we're answering with
yeah,
now.
Yeah, he manages the Blaine Beltran team.
Yeah. But yeah, Granderson had a period of that because I think he was beloved for his personality. Pretty much on a widespread basis mm-hmm. with Mets fans, but as he had like a rough start to the what was it, his last season with the Mets, I think either that one or the second
it was
last.
The one before that, I think.
Yeah, right.
That was when you made your famous Beltran will be better than Jay Bruce tweet.
The Granderson, yes.
I'm sorry, Granderson. Yeah, Granderson better than Jay Bruce, and you wore that as a badge of honor for that whole season.
Yes, I still will. It's still true.
It is still true.
cumulative stats to this day. But yeah, I think.
What about Matt Harvey? Would Matt Harvey be in that list?
I don't know. The only time, and like, this is an exercise in anecdotal evidence, and that's fine. Not everything has to be scientific, but the only time I remember people really getting on him was during the period of time that it turns out he had thoracic outlet syndrome.
I take off those rose-colored glasses, McShane. Think about like him going to Jeter's last game, all the shit he got for that.
Yeah, okay, all right.
There were a couple of like, why is he going out on the town things. Like I remember he went to a fashion show and people gave him a lot of shit for it.
Well, yeah, I mean,
he was just there to talk about Qualcomm.
Right.
I'm not defending all that stuff, but it just seems to me like a lot of that got blown way out of proportion.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, not Harvey or maybe Harvey, maybe Piazza, Duda, maybe Granderson. I would argue that there were a lot of players that got, like, for I would put maybe Mo Vaughn on this list. Not that Mo Vaughn was ever very good, but people were just mad that the Mets signed him. He didn't necessarily deserve the hatred he got, even though he was not very good.
Yeah,
like there are a lot of players like that. I'm not saying that we should have been happy about those guys, but there's a difference between being mad at those guys for their own reasons versus being mad at them for just existing.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anybody else that's jumping out at me.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure we're forgetting somebody.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't doubt that at all. If I could spend a lot of time looking back through everything, I would probably have some other specific examples. But I mean, I guess my point with Harvey was, you know, in his case, you had irrational hatred coming from WFAN and that kind of thing from day one of his career. Like, well, why'd he go to a Rangers game? Like, what? That's not bad.
Yeah.
You had things like that. But I'm just thinking of when fans started to turn on him. I think it was significantly later. And I could be wrong. Yeah, all the things you named. It could have been earlier than I remember. But just sort of the, like, oh, he sucks. I don't remember that happening until he had underlying injuries that we just didn't know about yet. From that point on, I guess, you know, he makes sense because people would, if he didn't perform well, it was his personality, not my favorite thing I've ever written for the site was one sentence, you know, the in-depth explanation of the analysis of what went wrong with Matt Harvey. And it's that he had the surgery for that. Yep. Like, so yeah, we could do a whole show about Matt Harvey's career retrospective with the Mets.
Yeah, I feel like we'd have to have Allison on for that. Allison is a big, I don't want to call her a Matt Harvey apologist because that lends a different tone, but Allison has lots of thoughts on Matt Harvey and his treatment by Mets fans. So we'd have to have her on if that was going to be a discussion we'd have. All right, well, let's use this opportunity to talk about Carlos Beltran's new coaching staff. So let's start with his pitching coach, which is a former Met, Jeremy Hefner. I know that I appreciated Hefner's personality when he was a Met, and I thought that he always gave really thoughtful answers to the press. But I don't have too many thoughts on him as a pitching coach because, well, I don't know him as a pitching coach. Do you have any particular good or bad feelings towards new Met pitching coach Jeremy Hefner?
Good feelings. I think everything that we heard about his role as an assistant pitching coach with the Twins was encouraging. And it's nice to hear current players saying good things about how they were helped. Certainly Beltran had that happening too. But yeah, Hefner, and I know it's sort of like a generic thing to say that, like, oh, that guy who had to work for it, the borderline guy, the guy who wasn't the superstar, and that's not Beltran, to be clear.
Right.
But that guy might be a better coach, or he might have some advantage in coaching because of the way he went through his own career. Whether or not that's the case, Hefner always seemed like he was a humble dude. And I do think that the guys who on a year-to-year basis don't know if they're going to be in the majors for all or some or none of a season are probably just more humble by nature.
Right.
So, yeah, I've always liked that about him. You know, he never rubbed anybody the wrong way as a player based on anything that, you know, has been written about him or reported. And I like the idea of a guy who's a little bit younger. I mean, you go with this younger manager in Beltran who has a Hall of Fame resume and should get in. And you have a couple guys here who know what it was like to play and in some cases played against or with some of the guys they're managing and plenty of the guys that they're going to be playing against. You know, that doesn't make everything, but I like the idea a lot. Are you any more optimistic or pessimistic on Hefner?
No, I think it's a good move. You know, I think that the Mets need to be getting more analytical, whether the Wilpons want them to or not. And I can't wait to not say that sentence anymore, but here we are still. You know, so having an analytics-friendly pitching coach is a really important thing, especially because the Mets' most recent on-field staff seemed to be very oppositional towards advanced metrics. And so when Mickey Callaway talks about trusting his gut over the numbers, you know, you want to puke. So having a guy like Hefner who was considered very analytics friendly, you know, I like that. That's speaking my language for the most part. You know, I don't have a ton of knowledge about the Twins. I know your cousin is a big Twins fan, so he maybe has more insight into what Hefner did for the team than I have. But I like the idea. And I also think that the Mets have been particularly bad about bringing back former Mets in different roles across the team. And so having a former Met as both the manager and the pitching coach is a good step in that direction. Even if we don't know too much about either of these guys in terms of actual tangible on-field managerial and coaching experience, I like the idea of the Mets not being afraid to honor their own, as it were.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a valid point. It's not the only thing you would make a decision on, but it almost seemed like they were allergic to doing it in the past. You know, we've got these choices, and like the former Met would be not the guy they'd go with.
Unless they played for the 86 team, then they'd be given more
yes.
chances. Your Tim Tuffles, Wally Backmans, Hojos, etc.
Yeah.
The Hojo wasn't on the 86 team, 88 team, whatever. You know what I mean?
Right. But yeah, no.
I don't think Hojo was on the 86 team. Now I'm doubting myself. Sorry. I was four.
He wasn't, right?
Go ahead. Keep talking.
No, sorry. Just battling a puppy.
Ah.
In a pleasant way. He's awesome, but he is full of energy right now.
it's amazing that for the first 30-30 player of all time, Howard Johnson is incredibly hard to Google.
Yeah.
Because of the restaurant.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see.
But yeah, it's...
No, he did play for the Mets in 86. He did. He went 0-4 in Game 2 of the World Series. All right. Anyway, I was wrong. He broke out in 87. But anyway.
Yeah, still. Yeah.
But yeah, any other Hefner thoughts?
No, just I'm sort of looking forward to what he can do in that role, and you know, it's a situation where I think I don't know, he has recent experience as a player. He has recent experience as part of a pitching coaching staff. Letting him take the lead on that, I think, is somewhat forward thinking and good. What's funny about pitching coaches to me is that over the last 5 to 10 years, several have been romanticized. And I'm not knocking the work they've done. There have been organizations and teams that have had these really good results or improvements. But then that only lasts so long. Who is the like mastermind pitching coach right now? Yeah, like I don't know. I just don't think it. I think a lot of the guys who get hyped up might not be the gold standard they're made out to be. So
yeah, I agree with that.
I don't know. I think it's pretty badass that Phil Regan oversaw an incredible half season of pitching.
Yes, I agree. If Phil Regan was even just 10 years younger, I'd have been all for bringing him back.
Yeah, and he might have been all for bringing himself back.
Sure, but a guy in his mid-80s is probably not suited for the grind of baseball any more than he had to be.
Right, and I know, and he's worked in this Mets organization for decades, and he lives and breathes it, but actually being in the dugout 162 times, plus spring training, plus any potential playoffs, and all that kind of stuff, that's a grind that I feel tired. If you told me that was going to be my job,
absolutely.
I mean, I'd be thrilled. I wouldn't know what to do, but I'd be thrilled. But I'd also go like, man, I'm going to be kind of tired by the end of this, aren't I?
So the other new hire for the Mets is their new bench coach. And do you know exactly how to pronounce his last name?
I will admit I do not.
I feel terrible that I don't know this. Hensley Mullins. Do we have a, should we pick one for tonight?
I'll say Mullins.
Mullins, okay. Hensley Mullins is the new bench coach. Beltran played with, not with him, but under him. He was a coach with the Giants when Beltran was traded there in 2011. I'm going to ask you a question. I hope you don't know the answer because it's a fun answer. Do you know how many languages he is fluent in?
I do not.
It's five.
Okay, nice.
English, Spanish, Dutch, Papiamento, which I believe is a like a Creole language, and okay. Japanese.
Jeez, so, okay.
It's pretty impressive.
That is useful based on the places that baseball players tend to be from.
Yes. He is from the island of Curaçao.
Right. I was going to guess that based on the... you said Dutch, right?
Yes.
I was going to guess that. So, yeah.
And his nickname is Bam Bam. You have to love a good nickname.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a lot throughout his career. He played in Japan. He coached the... in the World Baseball Classic. Who did he coach? Was it the... is it the Netherlands?
Maybe.
Might be the Netherlands. He was also one of the six candidates interviewed by the Yankees for their managerial position in 2017, along with Beltran, who obviously didn't get the job, but got the Mets job. And, he's... oftentimes you see this when a young manager is hired. The team tries to go after a veteran presence in the, to be his bench coach. And while he is certainly older than Carlos Beltran, he's not that old. He's 52 years old, which in coaching years is not all that old. And, we had talked before about Beltran's ability to communicate with players that were both Latin American and also born in the United States. It seems like Mullins has a similar, reputation for being a great communicator. And after the Mickey Callaway experiment ended, I think communication is going to be key in this clubhouse. And so I know, again, as hard as it is to measure the worth of a pitching coach, it is even harder to measure the worth of a bench coach. But overall, I'm okay with this. I like this, I suppose. Any feelings you have about this?
at the risk of being boring, no, I pretty much agree with everything you said. It's somebody with a level of experience. I think the being fluent in five languages is not something to sneeze at. That's extremely useful. In terms of, obviously Beltran is bilingual, but having that somebody around who can talk to almost anyone who might come through on his roster is good. And I like the idea of having somebody who Beltran is comfortable with already. There are some coaches who are going to be part of the staff that are sticking around from before Beltran. And that's fine. I don't think a manager on a baseball team necessarily has to have everybody fired and then pick his own. The fact that he's coming into knowing what it's like to work with the Wilpons for however long he does, knowing what it's like to work with Mullins, it can't hurt to have that kind of a comfort level.
Right. And he was a coach on the Giants for nearly a decade.
And Bochy is generally regarded as one of the best.
Yes, and the fact that he was able to be someplace for that long and in a team that had a lot of success in that decade bodes well for his ability with the Mets as well. So, yeah, welcome to the team.
Hey, I'm Jason Del Rey. I recently wrapped up Land of the Giants, The Rise of Amazon. In this podcast, we examine how Jeff Bezos turned a small online bookseller into one of the most powerful companies in the world. We start by exploring how Amazon Prime became a service with over 100 million members and the main source of the company's power.
I mean, I think that's kind of what Amazon's banking on, right? That you're just so locked in that you're going to go to any other sites because, I mean, I don't.
And we end the season by pondering the question, is Amazon too big?
You know, and we just don't want to be the United States of Amazon. We just really don't.
Land of the Giants has been recommended by the New York Times, Axios, Wired, and more. It's a candid look at the state of Amazon today, how we got here, and what the future might look like. The entire first season is out now. Find out more and binge it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
So we're avoiding a big topic because we're going to end with that. So let's get to the other little bit of Mets news today, which was that the Mets traded two relatively uneventful minor leaguers, or at least thus far relatively uneventful minor leaguers, for outfielder Jake Mariznick. Mariznick is a right-handed hitting center fielder, a glove-first center fielder who is not known for much with the bat, but will primarily be taking the Juan Lagares spot on the roster, maybe playing more than Lagares did, but sort of a similar profile to Juan Lagares. Because this is a Mets move, there are people who are very angry about this, as well as people who have a more measured approach. I know you're going to have a measured approach about this, Chris, because that's just the kind of guy you are. But tell us, what do you think of the Mets getting Jake Mariznick?
I think it's fine. I think I'm not throwing any celebrations over it or anything, but you look at the reality of what this front office probably has to work with, and assuming that doesn't change rapidly, they gave up a couple of minor leaguers who, I saw a reference today to prospect status or prospect value or some bullshit phrase thrown out there about Blake Taylor. And I'm not saying Blake Taylor can't be good, but until the Arizona Fall League, anybody who's saying that kind of thing about him wouldn't have said it at all. Not once. He was a nobody.
He was acquired for Ike Davis. How long has Ike Davis been off the Mets? I mean, if this was a major prospect, most ball players who turn out to be something special are not in the minor league system for as long as Blake Taylor has been in the Mets system.
Right. If the Mets acquired Blake Taylor for Juan Lagares, let's say Juan Lagares was in the exact same situation right now that Mariznick is in. Health, track record, performance, contract status. Like, I know what that reaction would be like. So it's just, like, why? How is their prospect status and value being thrown out there about Blake Taylor when I know if that were reversed, it would be that the Mets got another reliever who has just as much of a chance of making it as all the other ones they've acquired over the last few years. You know, that's really all I want in when people look at these things is consistency. And we're not here doing this show. We don't run this site. We're not here to defend the Mets, and I think that's been very clear over the years. But there is a point where you got to go just like, come on. Like, okay, they got him for as close to free as you can get a guy.
Right.
And he's useful. You know, he's not going to be the best player on the team. I could work up some anger about it if Mike Trout were a free agent right now. And the Mets were doing their thing of avoiding everybody who's elite and making a lot of money in free agency. And they got Mariznick and said, hey, center field is solved. Okay. I'd be a little bit more frustrated. But failing that, like not having that kind of a guy out there that who's available only for money, and he wouldn't have to be Trout, but just Carlos Beltran. There is no version of him right now you can go out and get. I don't know. It's fine. I think it can be useful. I don't know what else to say.
No, I'll add a couple little things to this. Look, I can understand if you're a believer in one of these prospects, you know, and we have a very robust minor league team at Amazing Avenue, and all of them will admit to having their guys, right? People who you just, for whatever reason, you're a fan of, even if there isn't a ton of reason to believe it, you like what you see in these guys for whatever reason. And so if you are a Blake Taylor or Kennedy Corona, head, if you love these guys, then I totally understand why you might be bummed out about this, especially because you're trading for a guy who has 1 year of control, right? So you're not trading for a long-term piece. This guy's a Band-Aid, and that's okay, you know, that we need those players too. But I can understand if you think that one of these guys is going to be the next big thing, going a little bit ballistic over this. But the people that I'm seeing angry about this are saying things like, well, you shouldn't give up any, you should only give up prospects when money alone won't do it. And I understand that perspective in a vacuum, but this is the fucking Mets we're talking about. Like, they just don't work that way under the Wilpons. Again, we now have limited number of times we're going to be saying that again, thank goodness. But the Mets aren't going to go out and sign Anthony Rendon. They're not going to do it. They're not going to spend big unless they absolutely have to. And so I think that Marisnyk, as a right-handed, maybe platoon partner with Brandon Nimmo, as a late-inning defensive replacement, as a, you know, maybe the guy who gets the bulk of the starts, if one of the Mets, you know, with whoever the most flyball happy Mets starter is, there are lots of ways to get Marisnyk in a game if you need elite outfield defense. And has been pointed out by many people, the Mets have very bad outfield defense right now. Nimmo is maybe the best of the bunch, and he's not a great defensive outfielder. Conforto certainly isn't. J.D. Davis, God help us if he has to make a play in the field. You know, it's a bad defensive outfield. Getting a glove-first outfielder is a smart move, in my opinion. I just don't get the anger over this. I just don't get it. You know, I saw somebody online today say that this is like trading for a slightly better Keon Broxton, except the Keon Broxton had 4 years of team control. And I just feel like the Mets traded for Keon Broxton because they thought Broxton could be something that he wasn't already, whereas this is, they just want Marisnyk to be who he's already been. To me, those are very different trades for that reason.
Oh, yeah. And Marisnyk is not a perfect player, but regardless of what they were doing with their sign-stealing schemes, the Astros thought he was worthy of rostering as they were a World Series winning and American League pennant winning and contending team. They kept him around, and he was a regular part of those teams. And not that you can take every role player off of every great team and then make a great team of your own. But I don't know. To me, if one of the smartest teams in baseball, regardless of their ethics about the game, if they were being praised as one of the smartest teams in baseball and he was on their 25-man roster for their dominant run of success over the last 3 years, and he's not 37 years old, I just don't, I can't say, oh man, oh, the Mets, they're idiots. Like, I just can't do that. I don't know. if he was good enough for the Astros over the last 3 years, and he was with them for longer than that, but if he was good enough for those 3 years, how is he not good enough for these Mets?
Could not agree more. Of extremely minor note today, the Mets signed two minor leaguers with invites to spring training. You know, we haven't recorded since the Mets signed the first of the minor leaguers, which was Chasen Shreve, former Yankee reliever, was signed a couple weeks ago. Today they signed outfielder Jarrett Parker and infielder Max Moroff to minor league deals. You know, I don't have any strong opinions about any of these three guys, but I'm all for making these kind of signings. You know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I admit I know nothing about the guys they signed today.
Yep.
Shreve, I remember. You know, in a major league sense.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, no, but sign them all.
Yeah. I do hope that they, because last year the Mets signed a ton of outfielders in this way. I mean, if you recall, Matt Kemp was technically a Met last year, along with guys like Rajay Davis and you know, Carlos Gomez, just, you know, bringing in these sort of flawed older players to compete for jobs. I mean, even Adani Echevarria was signed with that intent and then wound up being a major player for the Braves down the stretch, you know. So I do think that there is there's value in doing that. I just hope that they do that with starting pitching this year, because the Mets, I don't know how many more Corey Oswalt starts I can take before I go postal. You know, so sign a couple of veterans to minor league deals this offseason so that we can get a little more pitching depth from the team this year. Anyway, are you ready for our second email of the show?
Yes.
Okay, let me find it now. This is from our friend Ryan. He said, assuming we don't bid for Cole or Strasburg and assuming Wheeler leaves, spoiler alert, he does, what about signing Julio Teheran? He's younger than Wheeler and has thrown 30-plus starts in each of the 7 seasons. He links us into an article that projects Wheeler to get 500 and Teheran to get 218. What do you think about that idea?
I'm into it. You know, you could do worse, that's for sure. I mean, I feel like he sort of fell out of favor with the Braves. And obviously he hasn't been quite as good in recent years as he used to be, but serviceable pitcher, and giving them, you know, I'd take him over Porcello, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's not saying too much.
No, I know it's not, but
you're looking at a lot of other pitchers, like guys that I don't think. Like, for instance, the same article that Ryan linked us to says that Jake Odorizzi, he projects at 3 years and $51 million. I don't know if Odorizzi is that much better than Teheran, and Teheran's going to come for cheaper and for less years.
Yeah. And I think the deal that Pineda signed, Michael Pineda, signed to stay with the Twins, might be sort of instructive to Teheran.
Yeah, I was hoping the Mets would go after Pineda. What was the final number he signed for?
2 years, $20 million.
Okay, yeah, that's affordable.
Yeah, in theory.
Yeah, in theory.
But yeah, I think Teheran might be able to do a little bit better than that, but probably somewhere in the same ballpark, around that money per year for however many years.
Yeah, you know, especially if, you know, I always hate this idea of a pitching coach or manager, somebody saying I can fix him. I just get Victor Zambrano vibes when people say mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. But, you know, if there is something that Jeremy Hefner or someone in the Mets organization says, you know, oh yeah, I think if we tried this, this, and this, he would be a more effective pitcher. You know, for that kind of money and time commitment, I'm all for that. I have no one I am stumping so hard for that I'd be mad if the Mets signed a Tehran. Because the Mets aren't going after Ryu or Strasburg or Cole, unfortunately.
Right.
I hope so. But, you know, I've seen a couple of different projections for Cole getting $200 million. And the Mets just aren't going to play that. So.
Yeah. Nope.
Well, that brings us to our final topic of the night, which is Zach Wheeler no longer being a Met, signed to a 5-year, $118 million contract with the Philadelphia Phillies. I know you and I probably have some slightly different thoughts on this deal. So why don't you go first with what you think about Wheeler departing the Mets?
All right. So I'll try to be concise. In theory, I wish the Mets didn't have financial constraints and could have kept him around for maybe a little bit of a hometown discount, so to speak. Even at the deal he signed, it would be nice if that kind of deal wouldn't be like, oh, no, that'll break the Mets. But all that said, in isolation, if I'm a team, any team, if I'm a team that's going, all right, here's free agents, here are the free agents that are available. If part of your offseason plan is that you're going to sign Wheeler to that amount of money and that term, and you're going to get Cole or Strasburg, and you're going into this situation and saying, and since it's the Phillies, we can use their actual roster, saying, hey, we're going to get Wheeler. We know this is kind of expensive, but he's our number three. Aaron Nola's our number two. And either Cole or Strasburg is going to be our number one. That makes a little more sense to me. But in isolation, paying him that, I just don't understand. If you don't have the capacity to do both, I don't understand why you wouldn't just pony up for Cole and then pay Wheeler like a sub-ace salary instead. And I like overall, I like Wheeler. He was always a guy that I was rooting for to like turn that corner. And then at some point over the last year and a half, which is, I guess, ironic since the second half of his 2018 season was fantastic. But at some point I just kind of gave up and was like, he's okay. I don't know. I could be wrong. I think the Phillies will regret the deal. I could be very wrong. I'm not rooting against him, you know, as a person. But and hey, good for him that he got that deal. So many pitchers, Matt Harvey is a great example. But so many pitchers have given teams so much value in their younger years and then not really gotten to that point of getting that payday. And, you know, 2 years ago, if you asked, Zach Wheeler might not have been a major leaguer. You know, his recovery from Tommy John and performance afterwards was far, far worse than Matt Harvey's.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So there were no guarantees. So good for him. And then I guess tailoring all this to the Mets, I understand if a team, including the Mets, says, hey, you know what? Zach Wheeler isn't worth that contract to us. But what a good team would do, what a good organization would do, is make a run at the guys who we know are better.
Right.
And say, hey, we've got a few pitchers that we love. We have the best pitcher in baseball. The guy who's been a top 15 pitcher in baseball for his entire career until a bad 2019 season by his standards in Syndergaard. You know, we're going to get one of those guys and make them the number two, and Syndergaard can be the number three. And Marcus Stroman, as a number four is a luxury to have. And then Steven Matz rounding out the rotation. So it will never be framed that way because the Mets aren't going to do that. So Wheeler will kind of stand on his own as somebody who they decided to let walk. But yeah, that's where I'm at in terms of the future. And in terms of the past, and maybe this is just where you have to let yourself be a fan, but the way that things went after the trade deadline, I'm glad they didn't sell anybody. I don't care that they didn't trade him and that they got a comp pick out of the free agency process instead, because other than the 2015 run to the World Series and the 2016 run to the wild card game, 17 and 18 felt like very long seasons in a bad way. And
yes,
like we got truly enjoyable, exciting, chaotic in the best possible way baseball out of this team. And if the process of keeping Wheeler was not the most sound operating procedure, who gives a shit? Like, it happened to work out, and that's okay. And you can sit there and analyze and talk about the lessons that should be learned from not trading him and whatever. But you know what? He was part of a team that was a hell of a lot of fun. And every year, 29 teams don't win the World Series.
Yep.
So you have got to be able to have fun. And I'm not saying that anybody who works for the Mets sat down and said, hey, you know what? If we keep Zach Wheeler, I think we might go on a crazy run and have a shot at making it to the postseason. But it is what happened. And I don't know. That's my spiel. That's my Zach Wheeler spiel. I wish him luck in a general sense. I hope he doesn't torture the Mets.
Yeah, I ended my article yesterday about this saying that we wish him well in 143 games next season.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I stand by that statement. But, you know, so here are my thoughts with Wheeler. Wheeler is exactly the type of pitcher the Mets should have extended a number of years ago. And I think that if the Mets had extended him a number of years ago, this conversation, first of all, I mean, obviously this conversation wouldn't be happening, but I think that you could have gotten him at a discount. And I don't, unfortunately for Wheeler, I don't think he ever gets this contract. If he was extended two or three seasons beyond this one, when he was ending that contract, he would never get this length or amount of money again. And, you know, as a guy who tries to root for players and roots for players to make the money they deserve, good for him. This is a nice paycheck. Congratulations, buddy. Mazel tov. But I don't think he's worth $118 million. I just don't think he's worth it right now. I think he's worth 75 or 80, but this seems like a big, big overpay. And it seems like a big overpay for a guy who has been a good, not great starting pitcher. And, you know, you can make the argument that maybe the Mets didn't quite know what to do with him, and other teams valued his raw stuff because they thought, like we said before, that somebody could Victor Zambrano him, or I guess maybe the term should be Rick Peterson him, you know. But you understand what I'm saying, you know, just the fixing him in some way. And that, you know, rarely works out as well as you would hope. But I just don't think he's, I don't think he's a player that's worth more than $20 million a season right now. I just don't think that's the case. Sorry, Zach, you seem like a good dude. I will root for you, but I don't think the Mets make that move. That said, I think that, like you said, this shouldn't be a move that the Mets don't make for financial reasons. This isn't a move, if this is a move that shouldn't have been necessary because they should have extended him a couple of years ago. You know, there are still lots of reasons to blame the Mets for this, right? But I don't think it's necessarily blame the Mets because obviously they don't recognize his potential, which is what you've seen some people saying, that, you know, that the Mets made this mistake and that he's going to come back and he's going to bite them in the ass every time he pitches against them. And I don't see that, you know. He's a guy who throws too many pitches. He's a guy who gives up too many foul balls. He's fine. He's absolutely fine, but he's not worth $118 million to me.
Yeah, and there is there are some who have put out there that he's clearly better than Marcus Stroman, and I objectively just don't see how that's true. Stroman pitched in the AL East in a home run friendly ballpark, to say the least.
Yes.
And whether you're looking at 2019 stats, if the trend now is buying into recent performance, Stroman was better in 2019. And if the trend is to look at a little bit more than the last season, Stroman was better over the last 3 years as well. Not wildly better, but better.
Yeah.
And contextualizing for the league and the ballpark that they were playing in, that gap becomes more significant. So I just don't see, I know he's been throwing hard. I know he's got great stuff, but at some point results are results. And I am not saying that Zach Wheeler is Dylan G, but Dylan G had a stretch where he had 20 something or maybe even 30 starts over the course of parts of a couple of seasons, but consecutive starts where his numbers were fantastic. And I just don't think second half 2018 Zach Wheeler is who anybody should expect him to be. I think he's a solid number three who at times will look like an ace and at times will look like a number five.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I wish the Mets had an unlimited budget and could say, you know what? If you're a number four starter and we're paying you $24 million, who cares? We can eat that. Like we can live with that to keep you around. But yeah. And to your point, I guess if you're going to go back and, you know, criticize what the Mets did or didn't do, not extending him on a team friendly deal, that would be the thing to me, not the lack of trading him, but yeah. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah. You know, the Mets had such a confused outlook at the trade deadline this year with bringing in Stroman and all that. I don't know what they could have gotten for him. I don't know if the Mets realized in July that they were in it still, because they weren't playing like they were in it.
Right.
So who knows what their mindset was. You can always criticize a team for not making a trade. I feel like that's the easiest thing to criticize a team for in the offseason. But yeah, I mean, again, I wish he was the Met, but 118 over 5 is pretty steep. So, well, Chris, it's that time of the show to get to our music picks. What are you going to be highlighting this week?
So, delayed reaction here, given the way our recording schedule has gone over the last several weeks, but a band called Alton Goon, Altin, and then GU with an umlaut, N. A mix of Turkish and European musicians playing like psychedelic Turkish combo of music. They played at Desert Days. Their set was fantastic. They put out a record this year called Geese. Probably butchering the pronunciation of that, but G-E-C-E. I dare anybody not to like the opening track, and there's a lot of catchy music on there. but I dare anyone not to like that opening track. So that is my album recommendation for the week.
That sounds right up my alley. And it also sounds like it potentially lines up well with my selection for the week.
All right.
Which is, so it's a, are you familiar with the website, The Quietus?
I know of it.
It's a music website, and every year their best albums of the year list gives me like 10 albums that I'm like, why didn't I know about this when it came out? I'm only learning about it now in December, and I haven't been listening to this, you know, all year. Well, a number of years ago, 2016, they put this band, which is called $75 Bill, put out a record called Wood Metal Plastic Pattern Rhythm Rock. And I found out about it from the Quietus's end of the year list and was blown away by it. It's a duo out of Brooklyn. The guitar player uses a microtonal guitar, so he can get more like a sitar-ish tonality out of it. Their new album is called I Was Real. It's 9 instrumental songs. It's a guitar and drum combo, but they have a bass player on the record as well as a horn section, and it sort of lives in the middle ground between jazz and drone and sort of, you know, maybe like some stoner rock stuff. It definitely gets heavy at times. It never gets like jazzy in the sense of like blowing big solos, but more just like getting into a groove and it's really great. It's groove based, sort of drony, has a Middle Eastern vibe to it. It's very, very cool. And this was what I was going to talk about even before you picked your band. So it's an interesting combination of things today. So I Was Real by $75 Bill is my pick.
Nice. I'm into it.
Yeah. This should be some fun listening for us this week. And thank you all for listening. We appreciate it. Next week is the winter meetings. We're going to have a special podcast coming out every night for the winter meetings to update you on the goings on. We'll probably do a show next week, I say with a question mark. So we'll see. I know we're going to get an episode of A Pod of Their Own next week, so we'll make sure to stay tuned for the Amazing Avenue Family podcast so we can stay in your podcast feed as this offseason goes by. You can, of course, find out more about the Mets at AmazingAvenue.com. We have a lot on the website right now about the Zach Wheeler signing, about the Mariznick trade. Go to AmazingAvenue.com and find out more than you know already about the Mets from our incredibly talented staff. Amazing Avenue is also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can email the show, aaaudiopodcast@gmail.com. We appreciate the emails we got this week. Thank you. Please keep them coming. You can follow Chris on Twitter at Chris McShane. I am at Brian Dizanab. And until next time, let's go Mets and smell you later, Wilpons.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.